information you can trust, stories you can relate to, and tips and tactics you can apply on your next adventure. Hunting, fishing, camping, and everything in between. This is the Battle Mountain Podcast. Hey everyone, thank you for tuning into the show. Today I have Sarah Gamache on the other line. So Sarah, thanks so much for hopping on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited as well. I think one of the first videos I saw of you, you were jumping into basically a cattle tank, and I was just like, that's the kind of crap I do. So I don't know. I mean, obviously there's, I have so many questions about you and your life, and I'm always fascinated to hear how people get started into hunting. Cause obviously, as you know, that, I mean, that builds the entire foundation for what everything's to be moving forward. So with you, you know, what was your start in hunting, and what was kind of your progression?
Well, so my start was, I grew up in a hunting family. Well, my parents were divorced from the time I was one, but on my dad's side of things, he had hunted his entire life. So, he got me started hunting. I think I did my hunter's safety when I was around 11. And for those first early years, it was kind of just me tagging around the woods with my dad. Kind of just a way to spend time with my dad. You know, at that age, kids kind of aren't really, really into it. And so I kind of just enjoyed being out there with him and getting that quality time. And as I got older into my teens, I started taking it more seriously. I wasn't really good at any of the traditional sports in high school. I'm pretty uncoordinated. So I learned very quickly that I was not going to be successful in that realm. And then I really wanted to stick with hunting. I'm from a really small logging town out in Eatonville, Washington. And there was a lot of people that I grew up around that did hunt. Not a lot of females, for sure, is one of the only females, but it is considered like a hunting community. And so I think it was like in my teens, like 15, 16, that I even started going out hunting by myself. And the primary animals that I were hunting were blacktail and Roosevelt elk, is what we have here on the west side of the state. And I really enjoyed being out by myself, like having that independence and having kind of just that alone time out there in the woods was very like healing for me. And I enjoyed it a lot. And I didn't actually shoot my first deer until I was 19. So I spent a lot of time in the woods and a lot of time hunting before I was actually successful. And that was on a solo hunt. So I felt like that was a big accomplishment, you know, shooting a blacktail. And at that point I was rifle hunting. And that just kind of really kickstarted my journey once I had that first success. And I just knew like, okay, this is something I want to do for the rest of my life.
This is your thing. Yeah. I think one to your story, I kudos to your parents, one for not saying, hey, well, Sarah, you're going to have to stick out soccer and just suck because it's not our fault that you have two left feet. So that's great, you know, cause I've, as you've probably seen, I've seen parents that are the opposite. Right. And then on top of that, going out and finding your strengths and just learning by doing, building on top of it and becoming successful. So with your first blacktail hunt, you know, what would you say were some of the most monumental lessons that you learned all the way up until your harvest that were probably the most beneficial to helping you shoot your blacktail?
I think just like the diligence as far as, you know, finding the mental strength to not give up, because it can get very discouraging. And I think a lot of hunters experience that, no matter whether you've been hunting for a year or you've been hunting for 30 years, we always have that time in the woods where you start to get very discouraged. Like you haven't seen anything and you start to have negative thoughts. And that happens a lot with blacktail hunting. I don't know if you've blacktail hunted, but
I have not. No, ma'am.
They are very elusive creatures. And so, I mean, there are days, I mean, times when you go days and days and days of hunting and don't see one thing. So finding that strength to keep pushing forward and get up every morning and say, okay, maybe today's going to be the day, because at the end, you know, it essentially does pay off. And then I think that's what makes it so much more rewarding, is you can look back and look at all the time you put into it and that you never gave up. And then at the end, you know, I was rewarded with my first bucktail. So I think that was probably the main thing that I took, and something that I still have to look back on and remember even today in my hunting journeys when I start to have those negative thoughts or get discouraged.
Yeah. And agree 100%. It's very easy, you know, when you're out there alone in the middle of nowhere, to just start letting all these little things pile up. And before you know it, you're just, you know, I guess for lack of better words, being negative Nancy, and then nothing is turning out, you know? It's a slippery slope. you get started and there's nothing stopping you until you hit the very bottom.
Right.
Yeah. Cause I've been fortunate to get to hunt quite a lot as well. And I can tell you, I've had several that the story was very, very similar, you know. And I remember one year in South Dakota, I shot a buck and he jumped my string. That was like the second day of the hunt. And I shoot this buck and he jumps my string and I hit him really high. And I don't even think he died. I mean, it was up in no man's land. And I tracked him, came back the next day, you know, never found anything. So then 2 days after that, I shoot and I miss a buck. And then here I am on the seventh day of the hunt. I literally had 2 hours left. And I'm like, I'm just going to go. Today's the last day. I'm going to give it everything I have. Why not? I mean, what have I got to lose? And I ended up shooting a buck that night. But, you know, to your point, it's amazing the lessons that you can learn in the I guess, no quit attitude from hunting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, the trying to stay positive, I think, is always the key there. There's been a lot of hunts, just like you mentioned, where I have shot stuff in the final hours.
Yeah. And so, you know, aside from when you work on staying positive, are you focusing on times when you just say, hey, look, last time I had to, and it was last hour, last light. Are you focusing on times like that, or is there something else that you're doing to stay positive as well?
Yeah, it's mostly that. And I just do a lot of self-talk. I've kind of always been that way. And I will probably lead more into that too, when we're going to talk about like my shot process and working with Joel Turner. And
yeah,
there's just a lot of self-talk going on, and keeping myself positive. And yeah, looking back on previous experiences, even if they're not hunting experiences, like I always remind myself, everything happens for a reason. Hindsight's 20/20. You know, you look back and you realize, oh, that's why it went that way. It didn't make sense at the time, but now everything's lined up and I can see it more clearly now. And there's been too many times in my life, you know, where that's been the case. And so I just always try to remind myself of that.
Yeah. That makes total sense to me. You look back, you're like, well, the reason it didn't work out is because I stepped on that pile of sticks, you know, when I wasn't supposed to. And that tends to screw everything up when you're inside 40 yards.
Yeah.
But with, you know, with talking about mentality, we can jump into talking about shot IQ. I mean, that what a perfect segment. Cause, as you know, that there's a, probably, especially with taking Joel Turner's class and working with him, I mean, there's a lot going on between the ears when it comes to taking consistent good shots. So what were you doing before starting to work with Joel Turner, and how and what has he taught you that's really improved for and helped you improve?
Yeah. So when, like I said, when I started out hunting, I was rifle hunting, mm-hmm. and I was a hot mess. Like I had major target panic. You know, I had a great father figure that taught me, he was really big on hunter safety and handling firearms safely and that whole realm of things and getting me on the range and shooting, but nothing to really help get me through what's going on in your head and the panic, especially when you're young, you know. And
right.
I was shooting like big guns too, you know, that kicked. And so of course I'm scared of that. I'm scared of the scope hitting me in the face. So you have all these things going through your head. And then you add, when you get an animal in front of you, and then there's 10 million other things going through your head. And so there a lot of, I had a lot of struggles through, my years of hunting with the rifle. I had a lot of misses, I don't really remember ever wounding animals. I just think it was a lot of just clean misses. And so that bothered me, you know, that ate at me. I had no idea how to fix that. I don't think my dad knew how to fix that. Everyone is born with how we're wired, how our brains work with this target panic. And so I haven't been doing archery for very long. I started my archery journey about 6 years ago.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I was posting videos on my social media, and Joel Turner is someone that is from my small town that I grew up in, Eatonville, Washington. And he had seen one of my videos where I was punching the crap out of my trigger. I had like an index finger release with my bow, and he wrote a comment saying something along the lines of, "We need to get you in. I need to help you with this target panic. You need to come take my course." So luckily that was like right when I started my archery journey. So Joel got a hold of me when I was fresh, before I had really developed any bad habits. You know, I had my target panic, but I hadn't been shooting a bow for very long. So he invited me over to his house. He put me through his course. And for those of you who like haven't, who are listening, who haven't heard of it, it's called Shot IQ. And it's basically like the mental side of what you're talking yourself through in your head while you're taking your shot, to avoid basically having target panic and all those other outside thoughts that are trying to come in, and how to override, basically override that system. And so as soon as I took his course, it was a game changer. It was like a light switch for me, and I caught on to it very well. And he basically took me under his wing, and I started spending a lot of time over there. And, you know, I just can't even explain how refreshing it was to have that change in my shot. Like, looking back at all the struggles I had with a rifle and now having a bow, it was just like harmonious.
I could imagine.
I was just like, wow, I wish I had this from the very beginning.
Yeah. Isn't it kind of funny? Like, because, like anyone, you know, I've had times on hunts or whatever, you know, where you miss really bad, or target panic really just kicks you in the butt, you know, and you can look back at that and you're like, man, if I'd have known a little more like what I know now, I'd probably have hit a couple more of those animals. Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh man. Yeah. I tell you what, one time I had target panic and I drew back on this bull elk. It was like, I don't know, like a 340 class bull. And I'd snuck into something like 32 yards. And everyone listening is probably like, how the hell do you miss an elk at 32 yards? I'm wondering the same thing still. And I draw back and my target panic was so bad, I flinched. And my bow, I started to let down. And when I caught it, I tried to redraw. And when I tried to redraw, my face or something punched the trigger. And I was shooting a full metal jacket. And it literally hit the rocks right by his feet. And it bounced up going off into God and everybody else. And it was just like this lightning bolt going across the sky. Like telling me to pound sand, you know?
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah. But I like to tell stories like that because it happens to me all the time.
Well, it happens to everyone, and some people don't like telling those stories. So good on you for being willing to share that.
Yeah. I don't have a whole lot to hide. It's not worth it. But I personally have not taken Joel's course. I have been meaning to. I just haven't done it yet. But you are the list of many people I've talked to that they're like, it's such a game changer and so refreshing to just feel in control and not feel like you are hoping that you hit where your pin is.
Right. And that's a great way to say it. You know, every single time that it's going to be a controlled shot, and you're never going to have that doubt. And there's just something really, like I said, harmonious, something great feeling about that. That from here on out, I know every single one of my shots is going to be controlled, and I never have to go back to those horrible experiences in the past.
Well, I mean, literally it's like getting in a car and going, well, you know, hopefully coming up here on this left-hand turn, the car makes this turn.
Right.
You know, I mean, so being in control of it is just, it's just such a huge deal and such a huge process. So, now touch real briefly for people, on kind of what that process looks like as far as time frame, you know? I mean, do you go with Joel and in an hour he's helping you, or is it something that you go there and you work with him or do his program, you know, a couple times a week? Like what is kind of the process?
So when he puts on his clinics, they're about 3 to 5 hours, and it kind of just depends on what setting he's doing it in. He does a lot of collaborations, you know, like he's in the Elk Shape camps that Dan Staton puts on. Shot IQ is part of those camps. He used to do immersion clinics with Tom Klum, who he's an instructor coach from Rocky Mountain Specialty Gear, who teaches the physical side of archery. So you would take an immersion course, you'd get the physical side from Tom, and then you'd get like, you know, 3 hours with Joel to do the mental side. I guess I'm really lucky that I live so close to him. And so for me, yeah, taking that first course at his house initially was about 3 hours, but I go over there sometimes weekly. And it's not to like keep retaking his course. It's sometimes I'm tuning a bow, I need help with broadheads, I want to try out a different release system. We're friends, you know, I'm good friends with Bodie, his son. So sometimes I'm just going over there to shoot the shit and, you know, shoot their 3D course that they have at their house. But for outsiders who just want to, you know, have that one time class with him, it's about 3 hours. And then he does have an online course now. Well, his online course is easier to do because it's always available, where these clinics that he's putting on now are selling out. He's not doing as many. It's once he hit Rogan, things kind of changed.
Yeah, so. For real. I could totally imagine that, you know, any advertising a business that Rogan is talking about on his podcast would change anyone's.
Yeah, it's really been neat to watch him kind of blow up from, you know, this small town. He was a cop for, gosh, 20 years, and he just retired. And it's been, I'm a business owner myself, and it's been really awesome watching him getting to now have his own business and watch it grow and see how successful and how many people's lives he's changing. And he's now branching out into, like, outside of the shooting realm and working with, like, coaches of professional athletes, of people that, you know, are Olympic athletes, and helping them with the same type of mental stuff. And so that's just been really special for me, since we're such good friends, to see the success that he's had in that.
Absolutely. And that, you know, that speaks, you know, very highly of Joel, obviously, because as you know, it doesn't matter who advertises somebody, if they're not able to stand behind their product and do a good job, it doesn't matter, you know? So here he is, you know, he got more attention, but he rose to the challenge and is doing a great job, and then expanding, like you said, into the professional athletes and everything like that. So that's so awesome. I'm so happy for him. That's way cool.
Yeah. So definitely. You should try to do one of his in-person ones. I mean, the in-person ones are really awesome when you have one-on-one time with them. And I always try to push people to do that. And he does quite a bit of traveling across the United States now. So probably on his website has a list of his clinics that he's going to be doing for the year.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, I'm glad that, you know, I'm glad for a couple of things, that he's out there doing what he loves and he's helping a lot of people. But I'm also glad that you firsthand really experienced a lot of help from it. That's just awesome to hear. With your archery, I read a little bit, you know, that you obviously started just a couple of years ago. What was it? Was it Joel that got you into traditional archery as well?
Yeah, it was him and other friends of mine, Aaron Snyder. And then when I started working with Tom Klum, that's all he primarily teaches is traditional archery. And I got really good with the compound really fast, probably from, you know, working so closely with Joel. And I shot just a slew of animals the first few years and was very blessed to have a lot of success. And I kind of wanted the next challenge, and traditional archery was definitely that will humble just about anyone who thinks they're really good with a compound. Just go pick up a recurve and you're back at square one again.
Right.
So I've always just been the kind of person that enjoys challenges, and, you know, when I decide I want to do something, I really put my mind to it and and just go all out. And I cool. did that with the compound, and I was like, hey, let's start that journey again with a recurve.
Yeah. I mean, just by looking, obviously talking with you and getting to know you a little bit on the podcast right now, but also by kind of following along in your journeys and everything, you know, I can definitely see that you're the type of person that when you put your mind to something, you're going to do it and follow through. I respect that a bunch. So, great job, you know, putting your money where your mouth is and working your ass off. Cause that's just, it's so awesome to see, you know, it's just awesome. So now I want to jump over to your Africa hunt, because when I read that in the questionnaire, all these questions started coming to my mind. But first, I just want to hear your perspective of your hunt and of your spot and stock Cape Buffalo hunt, and just kind of tell the story. And then afterwards, I mean, I already have some questions right now, but I'll save those for when you're done, because I'm sure I'm going to have more after your story.
Okay. Yeah, so I did that. I think it's been 2 years now, 2.5 years, and I'm kind of a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. And so I'm always looking for activities and adventures and hunts that I can do that really get your adrenaline pumping. And I had visited Africa several times just for personal travel, and then I had gone on a hunt there only after like a year or two of bow hunting. And I made great friends with a PH over in South Africa. And so my husband and I traveled there and did a really awesome hunt, and I fell in love with Africa. And he brought it up to me like a year after being there, hey, do you want to come back and do a Cape Buffalo hunt? Because there's not a lot of females that have done it. I know that after hunting with you, you're fully capable. It's a terrifying hunt, but it's one that you're going to love. And I think you should consider it. So of course I was like, oh, hell yes, I do want to do this.
Were you hooked at terrifying hunt?
Yes, pretty much. So he had basically told me, you know, I don't take a lot of people to do this archery hunt. I do a lot of these with rifle, and they're just as terrifying doing it with a rifle. But I know you're very passionate about almost doing everything exclusively archery. So do you think you can get your poundage up to about 75 pounds, because that's what it's going to take? And I said, yes, I will start training and working out and, you know, putting more range time in and working my way up to that poundage. Cause I think at the time I was about at like 60 pounds.
Okay.
And so we basically started planning the hunt a year out, with that being the first goal of me needing to get to the 75 pound mark. And then also thinking about arrow setup. I mean, you're obviously not going to be using the same arrow weight and all that same broadheads as what you would for deer and elk.
Right. Right.
What I had been hunting before. So I reached out to Troy Fowler. He's also known as the Ranch Fairy. He's a very controversial figure in the archery community for his high FOC that he's always pushing. He works very close with the Ashby Foundation for putting together arrow setups for big game in Africa, pretty much like the Cape Buffalo and elephants and stuff like that. So I worked with him. We actually met in July in Texas. He brought some arrows that he had made for me, and I was shooting them and trying to hunt with them when I was in Texas to see how they performed. I didn't get to actually shoot anything in Texas, so that was a bummer. So I was basically showing up to 6 months later with an arrow set up that I was just praying was going to work. You know, we had done a lot of testing with it, and he had a lot of other people that had put down Cape Buffalo with it, so I was confident. So I got to that 75 pound mark. We were all good to go. My PH decided to try to talk me into doing it from a ground blind.
Okay.
And I said, I don't want to do that. I want to do it spot and stock. I want the adrenaline rush. And he was trying to talk me out of it for about 3 months. Like, he was sending me videos of people getting trampled. He was telling me personal stories where they had Cape Buffalo charge them. And he was like, please, please, please consider this. And so we came up with a deal that I would sit in the ground blind for the first day just to try it and see how I felt about it. And he even went as far as, I had friends that were hunting there like a week or two before me, and he put them in a ground blind and did not do spot and stock. And he was having them messaging me saying, oh, I think you need to do the ground blind thing. You know, he was trying everything. And I was not going for it. I was like, sorry, we're not doing it that way. So I flew to Africa by myself. My husband, I think he might have been deployed at the time. And it was during the Johannesburg riots. So there was a ton of violence and a ton of people getting killed in Johannesburg when I was supposed to be flying there.
Oh, so that was lovely.
Yeah, that just added to all of the hunt, you know, that I was already going in, like, risking my life to shoot this buffalo. Now I'm risking my life flying into Johannesburg. But I still made the decision to go and it ended up being fine. And so I got there. We sat in the ground blind for the first day, and I was like, no, I can't. Like, I literally fell asleep in the ground blind. I was like, I can't do this. We're doing it on the ground. So,
well, you're not the only one that's fallen asleep in a ground blind.
Yeah, right. There is nothing exciting about it. So it was supposed to be where I was supposed to have a cameraman that was going with me to film this because I really wanted it on film. That was one of my goals. I wanted to put this thing down with just one arrow. I didn't want it to have to be put down with a rifle, and I wanted it all on film, and I wanted it spot and stock. Those were my goals. My cameraman canceled on me leading up to, it was basically the Johannesburg stuff going on and us kind of having to change flights, and it just got to be too much, so he couldn't go. So when I showed up, how it was supposed to work is we have myself as the hunter and then the two PHs, and they would both have rifles.
Okay.
Well, because my cameraman canceled on me, one of the PHs now had to become the cameraman, taking away one of the rifles.
You're like, put that rifle down. You need to use this camera.
Yeah, this is more important. I need the camera. So they decided they were going to take one of the Skinners out on the hunt. And the Skinner was a young boy who had always just stayed back at the lodge and skinned the animals. He had not been in the field on a hunt. But they were going to bring him, and they were going to have him carry the rifle. And what was going to happen is when the buffalo charged us, the cameraman was going to drop the camera, turn and grab the second rifle from the Skinner so that then we'd be back to having two rifles.
Okay.
So we all talk about how this is going to work. We know the buffalo is probably going to charge us because that's what they do, or they mock charge. They're extremely aggressive. They're one of the most dangerous animals. They call them Black Death. And so we were all under the understanding that was what was going to happen. We were told when it charges, we're not supposed to run. You're supposed to stay in a group and yell and make ourselves look big and try to prevent this thing from trampling us. Because where we are hunting, there is no trees to climb. There is no cover. Like, you can see the videos of my hunt. Like, we're dead if this thing wants to kill us, you know.
Don't let me forget, sir. I don't mean to catch up. I'll get the link. I'll put the link. If you have a link to that hunt, I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a couple of videos on my Instagram. So anyways, we get out there, first day of the hunt. We have to get within 20 to 25 yards of this thing. And so when you know how it is, like when animals are so, or any target that you have in front of you, it's so big, it seems closer
yep.
than it actually is. So we're getting close to this thing and I'm like, okay, like this has to be 25 yards. And he's ranging for me and he's going, no, this is 40 yards. Like, we still need to close like 15 to 20 yards.
Oh my God.
And this thing is just looking at us so pissed off, like it wants to kill us. So sure enough, as soon as we start getting closer to it, it decides to charge. And when it charges, everything goes to hell, because what happens is the PH that has the camera drops the camera. And you'll see in my videos, that's why I don't have good footage of the charge. Like, you'll see the beginning of it, but then you'll see the camera fall. That's him dropping the camera, because then he goes to turn to the kid to get the rifle. The kid is running in the opposite direction with the rifle, hits the ground and is curled up in fetal position, basically crying with the rifle. And here's the PH yelling and screaming, trying to catch up to him to get the rifle, pry the rifle out of his hand. So, you know, and I'm just like, okay, I'm going to die. Like, this is not good. So that was the very first, like, hour of this hunt. That's what happened. And I'm like, oh, great. So I tell them, no, we're going to keep filming. Like, we're just going to keep trying this. You just tell this kid he needs to get his shit together. So we continue to do stock after stock. To make a long story short, we get mock charged three times, and it's getting within like 40 yards of us every time and stopping. And the PH explained to me, this is what they do. Like, they kind of give these warning charges, but then eventually they're going to come all the way to us. And we're getting to that point. Like, this thing is pissed. He's given us three warnings. Like, we need to get this done because we are going to get killed. And I'm like, oh, no pressure at all.
Okay. Right, right.
Trying to keep my... And this is where I said I do a lot of self-talk. Like, mm-hmm. there was a lot of self-talk going on during this hunt. A lot of, Sarah, keep it together. When you get to the point where you have a shot, you need to go through your shot process. I have Joel's voice in my head of what I need to do of making a controlled shot. So the bull wouldn't turn broadside to us. They're smart. They always want to stay
facing,
face on, frontal. And so we didn't talk about a frontal shot, but essentially we kind of realized I might need to do a frontal. So at this chance that we got where this thing is about 25 to 30 yards, he's facing us and I'm getting ready to do a frontal, which I have not done a frontal on any animal before. And so okay. I'm like, okay, this is, let's see how this goes. Well, right at the last minute when I'm getting ready to pull back, he turns broadside and I'm like, okay, here we go. And I have really good footage of this. You'll see him turn broadside. I pull back, I execute a perfect shot. And I have a hinge release. You cannot punch a hinge release. If you shoot one, you know, like you have to go through your process with a hinge. It's not going to be a good shot. So I perfect shot. He took off. We were all excited, celebrating. And we're like, you know, now like we're not out of the red zone. Like
right.
The actually more dangerous part is now tracking this animal. If it's wounded, there's thick brush. So it could be in the brush where we can't see it. It could charge us. So we gave it hours. I mean, at least 2 hours before we started tracking it. And he had gone a few hundred yards. He had found like a mud hole and we found him dead in a big wallow basically that he had kind of rolled in, which actually I think he had pushed the arrow even more in when he got into that mud hole.
Gotcha.
I don't know how much initial penetration I got when the shot went in, but when we got to him, it had gone through both lungs and it hadn't quite came out the other side. They have really thick ribs and thick hide, and then they roll in that mud and then mud dries and then it's even another coat of thickness. So that's why it was so important to get close to them and have a good arrow set up to get that penetration.
Yeah. Do you know, talking about, well, first off, congratulations. I mean, what an awesome adventure. And I too am an adrenaline junkie. So I completely understand all of that because yeah. Like when I used to ride bulls and stuff. So I get it, you know, an adrenaline junkie, it's in you.
Yeah.
So, with your arrow, that's probably, I mean, I have other questions, obviously, pertaining to the stock and everything like that. But with your arrow itself, do you remember, you know, like the overall weight of the arrow? And I would imagine you're shooting a fixed blade cut on contact broadhead.
Yes. I believe the total arrow weight was 750.
Holy crap.
Yeah. I mean, this thing was insane. The broadhead alone was 300 grains. It was a tough head broadhead, yeah, cut on contact, single blade. So it was what Troy Fowler had put together for me and what we thought would perform the best, and it definitely did. But, yeah, I can't remember what the FOC
was
on it. Maybe like 23% or something. But, yeah, it looked like I had a lawn dart on the front of my arrow. The thing was stupid.
it's almost like you're shooting a fiberglass fishing arrow.
Yeah.
I mean, geez. Do you know for the arrow itself? I was in a bow shop one day and they were making arrows for a Cape Buffalo hunt. And they were actually, they had to fill the arrow full of salt or something like that so that it was heavy enough. Was yours just a really thick walled arrow or did they have to do anything like that?
It was called a Sirius arrow was the brand. And yes, when Troy built it, they put in like in the front part, like, a post basically like a metal post to fill that. Yeah. Like, just like exactly the same concept to get more weight up front.
Golly. Isn't that crazy to think? Cause I mean, you look at the arrow again, and you mentioned this obviously that you're not going to use the same arrow that you would for elk and deer, but how drastically different that is compared to your other arrows.
Yeah, I mean, there was some definitely tuning challenges. And that was another reason for having to stay within like 25 yards, because once you start getting further out, there's some funky things that start happening with those types of arrow setups.
Oh, I can imagine.
But it was pretty dead accurate out to about 25, 30 yards for sure. I was extremely confident with how it was going to perform.
That's crazy. So during the stalk on this hunt, you know, I've never been to Africa. Is it as if you were spotting and stalking other animals? You know, you kind of, you see them and you're trying to not be seen as best you can, or are they not quite as weary because they know how big they are and things like that?
Yeah, for the Cape Buffalo, because I've spot and stalked other animals there too, like some of the plains game and stuff,
yeah,
that are extremely skittish. No, the Cape Buffalo are not like that. So,
gotcha.
You know, they kind of will stand around and hold their ground, and you can get within a certain distance, and then they'll either mock charge you or they'll take off, and they might run 100 yards or so and then kind of stop, and then you have to, you know, close the distance. And it's kind of just a game of cat and mouse. I mean, they know you're there. They see you, obviously, when you start to get close. There wasn't a whole lot of cover. So it was kind of just, I can't even remember how many times, how many failed stalks we had. You either have to get there close enough and hope they don't run, or get there close enough and hope they don't charge you. And just kind of, that's where the pH, you know, comes in, where they can read their body language and their mannerisms so well to kind of know what to expect in every situation.
Gotcha. Yeah. It seems like hunting something, you know, that is so, so big and so unafraid. It seems like like you said, that they would kind of stand their ground. Like, yeah, what do you think you're going to do?
You know? Yeah. I mean, and some people compare it to like a cow, like, oh, they're just a cow. And it's like, yeah, you think that until you're standing and the thing is like looking into your soul. And if you read about people that have hunted Cape Buffalo, that is like the common denominator that you will hear everyone say, is they just have these eyes that they're looking at you like, yes, I'm going to kill you. And that's what makes it scary.
Yeah. It's the same eyes that like a fighting bull have, you know, they're like, right. I want to run you over.
Yeah. It's a lot different than just your everyday, you know,
moo cow. Yeah. You're not going to go out there and like milk it.
Right.
Oh, geez. Yeah. What were your, as soon as that arrow release and you saw it hit, what was your reaction?
I honestly was more scared at that point than I ever was, because I was like, for those first few seconds was like, I mean, it ran the opposite direction and I saw it run, but for some reason in my mind, it felt like it was like going to come at us. And so I was actually just like terrified, hoping that, okay, this thing is going to go the opposite direction, right? And not going to kill us. So it was kind of like a fear at first, and then just like the adrenaline dump of, holy crap, I did it. And I survived it. And now we just have to find, it was short celebration, because then, like I said, then you're almost up to the more dangerous part of the hunt, of finding the animal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like going into the brush after a wounded, you know, bear or something. I mean, it's all dangerous. It's just, and especially that brush, it's so thick, you can't see anything. It's crazy.
Quite the roller coaster of emotions, just a lot of ups and downs, you know, because every time, you know, it would charge us and you go through that whole excitement, then you have to get your nerves under control and get your adrenaline down, and you have to, you know, keep going.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a lot of that stuff going on.
Holy smoke. The ups and downs on that, as they try to kill you, you know, and charge you, I couldn't imagine. I bet that was the adrenaline rush you were looking for, though.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, you know, I enjoyed it so much that in August, I'm going to go back and do spot and stalk on a lion.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So we'll see how that goes. I don't know if that's technically more dangerous than a Cape Buffalo, but we're going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, why not?
So we can maybe do a follow-up podcast after that.
That would be, that sounds incredible. I'm all for that. That's a wicked cool story. You know, number one, I know, I'd imagine, you know, cause I watched, people have to do and work out and things like that so they can draw a higher poundage bow. And it's not like it happens overnight. You know, so, all the work and effort and everything that you put into that is just, it's incredible, because that's a process, you know? So not only kudos to you for that, but man, keeping all your shit together after they bluff charged you, you know, seven times.
Yeah.
And your cameraman's running, or not your cameraman, the rifle holder is running.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Oh, geez. Well, cool. So that's actually kind of a great spot to jump into one of the next topics that I want to talk about with you. And that's, you know, mentality as well as physically working out And then I want to touch a little bit on cold plunges. You know, I've seen a few of the ones that you've done and things like that. But you know, having an animal charge you, I would say that's a pretty good, test to your mentality right there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, you know, with any hunt, there is certain obstacles that pose a challenge. And I'd, judging by just talking with you today, I would imagine those challenges are what drives you to hunting, it sounds like. And I thrive off the challenges as well. So, what, aside from doing things like the Shot IQ, you know, what type of things do you do to make yourself mentally stronger? Is it as simple as you just shoot your bow a lot? Or who knows what it is, but I'm kind of curious to hear.
Yeah, just kind of looking for things to get me out of my comfort zone. I'm an entrepreneur, so I've started several businesses. I've done a lot of things in life that sometimes people avoid because there's risk involved or it is pushing them out of their comfort zone. And I'm just a true believer in pushing myself to do those things. And I think a lot of what I enjoy is just the reward at the end. Is what keeps pushing me to do these new things is that it's so great, you know, when you accomplish your goal to look back at everything you had to do to get there and just how it was so worth it. And then it's like every time I accomplish a goal, then I'm like, okay, what's my next thing going to be?
Right.
You know, what now can I push myself to do? And it's kind of just to keep life interesting. You know, like my biggest fear in life is failure and complacency. Like I'm not someone that can live like 9 to 5, white picket fence. Like I wasn't built for that. I'm built for adventure and challenges and getting out there and working hard and pushing myself to the limit. And even like you had mentioned the cold plunges, you know, that's a big part of it. There's some health benefits and some things I've seen on that side of it, but really it's that I freaking hate cold water. I have my whole entire life. And there's just days where I feel like I need to push myself out of my comfort zone. And if that means jumping in a freezing river or, you know, that water trough one that you've seen, you know, then that's what I'm going to do. So whenever I feel that I'm getting lazy or complacent or just living day to day, you know, kind of carelessly mundane, then I'm like, okay, what can I do? And then that's when I will start planning whether, hey, I'm going to start a business or I'm going to plan this crazy epic hunting adventure. And that's kind of just always how I've been.
Yeah.
From a young age.
Yeah. So you mentioned fear of failure and complacency. Where did that come from in your life?
I think it came from my mom. Like I said, my parents were divorced from a really young age. So I was raised by a single mother and she just really ingrained it in me, you know, that you need to be independent. You need to find success in life. She was very much one of those where you're not going to marry a man that's going to take care of you. You're going to take care of yourself. You're going to go to college. You're going to get a job. You're going to do all this, you know, the right way. And so I excelled in school, like academically, I was very smart. And so I did a program called Running Start that's offered here in Washington where you can go to college when you're in high school. So I think it was my junior year. I didn't have to take any high school classes. I stopped going to high school altogether and I was enrolled in a community college where I was taking classes to get my AA, my associate's degree. And so I was 16 years old, going to college, taking 3 classes, which is considered full time, and then working. I found a job right at 16. And so I always, from the start, paid my own bills. Like I wasn't even having my parents, I wasn't relying on my parents for stuff. I could pay my own car bill, my cell phone bill, my insurance, all that, and then going to college. So I graduated with my associate's degree before I even had my high school diploma, which is how the graduation ceremonies worked out.
Yeah.
And then from there, I went to on to another college, a university, and got my bachelor's degree. So I got my bachelor's degree in business and marketing when I was 20. And, you know, I've always had a job from the time I was 16, whether that was working for a company or starting my own businesses. And I, like I said, I just found so much reward in having that independence and doing things for myself and not relying on people and pushing myself and, you know, never giving up no matter how hard it was.
Well, that's awesome. I respect that a ton. I think, you know, especially nowadays, you see where it's with everyone in general, it's just more and more the opposite. And so I respect that a ton. And I'm curious, you know, with your kids, are you doing kind of similar things where you're teaching them to be independent and everything as well?
Yes, very much so. I'm constantly pushing them out of their comfort zone. I mean, I did a cold plunge on New Year's. We went down to this river that I grew up by, and it was probably 30 degrees outside, and I don't know how cold the water was, but it's extremely cold. And I took my kids with me, and I said, you guys are doing this. You know, my daughter's 12 and my son's 9, and I said, you're getting in, and I don't care how much you think you're going to hate it. And it's funny because however much they complain about it, and fear it and, you know, say, no, there's no way I can do this. After they did it, they saw the same rewards that I do as an adult. Like, yeah, they were excited about it. They were telling their friends at school, you know, I took videos of them doing it. So I wanted to show people videos. They came home and were telling my husband all about it. So it's really cool to see them have like the same emotion and positivity when I push them to do stuff, you know, like with my daughter. Same thing. She's old enough to hunt. So I take her hunting with me, or I take her hunting. And, you know, I took her to Idaho this year, and it was super cold. You know, it was in November, and we were mule deer hunting and putting on miles, and she was miserable. And, you know, getting up early, which kids don't like to do. And it was just her and I, and we were going way, way up high and no cell phone service, and she ended up shooting a deer. And I was like, you know, it's you and I, we're doing this, girl. You got to gut this deer, you got to help me drag this deer. Like, I'm very big on, you know, making them do that whole process.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it's been really rewarding pushing my kids to do that and watching the positivity that comes from it.
Yeah, it's awesome hearing that. You know, it's interesting hearing you talk about the cold water and the fear that surrounds that with kids. Cause I had the same conversation with my 11-year-old. You know, I was talking to him about, cold showers and things like that. And, I just said, well, let me ask you, is it going to hurt you? And he's just like, no. And I said, okay. Is it going to feel uncomfortable? And he's like, yeah. And I said, yeah, absolutely. But being uncomfortable is nothing that you can't learn to deal with. And I said, when it's all said and done and you get out of that, I promise you're going to feel better. And I'm like, just remember, it's only water, you know? And, yeah, and, right. And it was weird. You like watch, it's funny. Cause I'm glad that you chuckled at that. Cause really in the simplest form, it's only running. It's only doing pushups. It's right. I mean, yeah. You're hiking out of a hellhole and it's only one foot after the other.
Right.
You know,
and it's all only temporary.
Yep. 100%. And it's like people get so worried, and myself included, it's happened to me as well. But as much like you said throughout this whole podcast, like you self-talk, you build on yourself, you learn and you get better. And man, my kids have done some crazy, crazy hikes. My 11-year-old now, when he was 4, in 2.5 days, we walked like 14 miles.
Wow. That's incredible. That's awesome.
You know, and just this last year, we hiked in, we shot an elk. We left the truck at 11:30. I got back to the truck the next day at 2:30. And I straight line distanced it out myself. Straight line distance, I walked like 23.9 miles. Jeez. And my kids walked like 13.
Wow.
You know,
that's crazy.
And I was, so with that said, you know, I don't say that to like, ooh, look at me, you know, not at all. I'm telling those stories you know, to kind of chime in on your stories. And I'm really curious to have your input on what I'm fixing to ask based off of what you told me about your kids and the cold plunges and how you want them to be independent. I think, in my opinion, society looks at kids and they think, well, they're just kids. What can they really do? And what I've found is your kids have the limits that you put on them. And if you expect more, they give more. And I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I mean, that, yeah, that is so true. And I do see that with my own kids. And we communicate very clearly with our kids what our expectations are, whether that is in regards to their behavior, whether that is in regards to, you know, how they perform academically at school. Like, that's made very clear. We have very good communication. So they always know what is expected of them. And if they fail, you know, then we evaluate, well, why didn't you reach your goal? You know, what can you do differently? How can we help you, you know, be bigger and better? And, you know, we work very well as like a team, as like a family unit, mm-hmm. to support each other, no matter if it, you know, whether it's me going on a hunt or something my daughter's trying to accomplish. You know, like my husband's really big on working out, and he stresses the importance of, and I do too, but it's mostly my husband has been more in that lifestyle than I have. Just how important it is for mental toughness, for your health, obviously, and that they need to take care of themselves and their bodies. And he gets my 12-year-old daughter up every morning at 4:30, and they go to the gym and work out together before she goes to school, you know. And I think it also helps when you're doing it together.
Yep.
You know, when she's getting to work out with her dad, she's getting to go out and shoot her bow with me, or maybe we're going to a 3D shoot and all four of us are shooting together.
Yeah.
I think that plays a huge role when you can find things to do with your kids, alongside your kids.
No, you couldn't have said that better. Cause like, let's be honest, right? Your kid is not going to look back when they're 30 years old and say, man, you remember that time we were all on the couch and we watched that movie?
Right.
You know, but they will say, do you remember 100%. How often me and dad woke up at 4:30 in the morning and went to the gym and crushed it?
Yeah.
That's like, that's cool.
Yeah, she's definitely going to remember those things.
Exactly. That's all. Well, I'm glad that you guys all do stuff together as a family and get your kids involved, because that's a huge passion of mine is getting kids involved. So I love to hear other parents out there doing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I became pretty passionate about too, you know, with hunting and outdoors, is getting more kids involved, because I'm pretty sure it's probably still a true statistic, but for a long time, the only growing demographic in the hunting industry, like the only new hunters numbers that were growing, were women and children. And they've also said, I think it's like, if the mother of the household hunts, there's a 75% chance that the kids will hunt as well. So like I said, just stressing the importance of doing stuff with your kids and getting them out there. And I've sent my daughter to a really awesome outdoors camp in Texas for 2 years, where she goes for a week, and it's all with kids her age, and they teach them everything you can imagine hunting. Like, they have archery classes, rifle classes. They teach them how to track blood, how to score animals. I mean, just how to call, everything from start to finish. And that was huge for her too, because I could take her out and do stuff, but kids, they only listen to their parents so much.
Right, right.
And sometimes it helps if you can get them doing it with other kids their own age as well.
Yeah. And what's the name of that camp?
It's called Outdoor Texas Camps, I believe, and they have they have girls camps and they have boys camps, and they have hunting ones and fishing ones.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I flew down the first year she went and actually helped with the archery class, and it was really awesome. It's just so cool to see those girls like get bows in their hands and start them on their archery journey and watch how they grow and develop just over that 7-day period that they're there.
Yeah, just watch them light up.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. Well, you know, Sarah, before we end this podcast, I do want to touch a little bit on the things that you have going on, you know, with, you know, the group hunts that people can come do with you, as well as other, you know, the women's outdoor related retreats and things like that. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that before we wrap up the show.
Okay. Yeah. I started kind of putting together group hunts a couple of years ago, and it wasn't really planned. It was kind of just, we invited some friends on some hunts. Like, actually Africa, I think, was the first one. And it kind of evolved because then they wanted to keep going on hunts, and they wanted to bring friends, and those friends wanted to bring friends. And I found it very rewarding because I obviously enjoy my own successes, but I also love seeing other people be successful in the field. And so it was extremely rewarding for me going on hunts with other people, and especially like women or new hunters, you know, and watching them be successful. It was almost like me reliving my first kill, maybe.
Absolutely.
Better, you know? So that's kind of how that came about. And I just started forming relationships with different outfitters internationally and within the United States. And, you know, I'll go to an outfitter and say, hey, if I bring this many people, what discount can you offer us as a group rate? And so they'll end up getting a deal if they come on these group hunts.
I got
you. And then I kind of put together all the details and the itinerary, and especially on the international hunts, it's very intimidating for people, might be outside of their comfort zone, especially if they're not traveled internationally. So I'm kind of there as like the travel agent to walk them through how to get their passport and all the details of, you know, getting to and from the destination and answering all their questions that they have. And we do groups, you know, that could be five people, or like we did one in New Zealand where there was like 12 of us. So the groups are all different sizes, all different species of animals, all over the country. So I have one, one that's coming up in Australia in March of this year. So if there's people that want to do that, it's kind of last minute, but I have a couple spots. And then I do group hunts for South Dakota mule deer. This year is full, but 2025 is open. New Zealand 2025 is also open for a red stag hunt to go to the same place that we went last year. I post everything on my website.
Okay.
So if people like want to see, you know, the details of these hunts, the costs and all that, it's pnwhuntress.com. And yeah, that's basically the gist of it. The women's retreats, I don't personally put any of those on. I kind of get asked to collaborate or go be an instructor at those. There is one coming up in June, that Tana Grenda, she does Bristol Bay retreats, and she's working with a gal in Idaho. I don't have a lot of details, but I think it's about 75 to 100 women that they're going to bring to it. And it's, I believe, 5 days, and it's going to be hunting, trapping, firearms, I'll be teaching the portion of that. So I'm really looking forward. Those retreats are really special. I've been on a couple of them, and if people are listening and haven't gone on one, I highly recommend doing those.
That sounds, yeah, that I could totally see where that would not only be really informational, but it being around a bunch of other people that are interested in learning and learning the same thing, like how powerful.
Yeah, it's amazing, the lifelong friendships. That's another one of my favorite parts of the group hunts, is the bonds that you form. And then, you know, a lot of these people, like, we just end up hunting year after year and traveling all over the world together. It's a lot of the same people end up doing multiple hunts. So it's really been cool to make those relationships.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Sarah, I had an absolute blast chatting with you and telling stories and asking questions. So, and sharing a couple of my own stories. So I just appreciate you taking the time out this evening and hopping on the podcast.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. Thank you so much. I always enjoy doing these. I haven't done one in a while. And so this was good conversation, and I hope people enjoyed it. And like I said, if you want to do a follow-up one, maybe like at the end of the season, that would be great.
Yeah. I would love to touch bases and maybe hear more about this spot and stalk tiger hunt or lion hunt.
Yeah, hopefully I'm alive to tell it. My husband got an insurance policy on me after the baseball hunt. So.